Hello, everybody. I'm Howie Hawkins. I was the Green Party and Socialist Party candidate for president in 2020. And this podcast, Green Socialist Notes, is about continuing to educate and advocate for the eco-socialist program that Angela Walker, my running mate, and I ran on in 2020. And again, you know, top of the things we got to talk about now is this war in Gaza. And one of the things I want to emphasize is that we should understand that this is not just Israel. The U.S. is a complete co-belligerent and co-responsible for the genocide going on in Gaza. And we'll put in the chat an article by Gilbert Achkar, which I think really brings that home. It's short and it's worth a read. But what one of the things he shows in there is that U.S. support for Israel has just grown stronger over the years. It wasn't always this way. During the Eisenhower administration, the U.S. did not provide arms to Israel and tried to be an impartial broker and arbiter between Israel and the Arab states and the Palestinians. In fact, Eisenhower got the UN in coalition with the Soviet Union to oppose Israel's joint attempt with Britain and France to take over the Suez Canal from Egypt. And because France and Britain vetoed in the Security Council, the General Assembly of the UN used the Uniting for Peace provision they'd adopted in 1950, you know, to authorize force against Israel, Britain, and France if they didn't stop their invasion. That was enough to stop them. Very different than today when Biden is, you know, joined at the hip with the Israeli administration. It was in the Kennedy administration that the U.S. established its so-called special relationship with Israel, which at that time was part of the geopolitical strategy of the Cold War against the Soviet Union. And Kennedy threw U.S. weight behind Israel and against Arab nationalists and socialists, some of whom were aligning or seeking aid from the Soviet Union. And he started sending arms to Israel. And that continued under Johnson, but Johnson did not openly support Israel's war against its Arab neighbors in the 1967 war. I mean, how could it? It couldn't endorse an invasion of the West Bank, which at that time was controlled by U.S. ally Jordan. So very different than today, where it's, you know, 100% support for Israel. Nixon strengthened the special relationship during the October 1973 war, which, you know, Egypt and Syria had initiated against Israel. And so the U.S. sent emergency arms shipments. But that's what led to the occupation of the West Bank. And, you know, the resolutions from the U.N. calling for a two-state solution. And that's, you know, where things have been frozen, except that Israel keeps encroaching on the West Bank and Gaza under the Reagan administration. The U.S. did not support the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982, and it intervened as a mediator to facilitate the evacuation of the Palestine Liberation Organization combatants in Beirut, helped them get out of there safely. Very different than today. Under the first Bush administration, H.W. Bush, the U.S. put pressure on a few occasions to stop settlements in the West Bank and Gaza. And under Bush 1 and also Clinton, the U.S. Supported the Oslo process, problematic as it was, but it was toward a two-state solution and continued to condemn the settlements. Then under George W. Bush, Bush 2, the U.S. did not support Israel's 2006 invasion of Lebanon, nor its offensives, which were repeated against Gaza. And then under Obama, the U.S. continued to condemn the settlements and, you know, got in a very, you know, touchy relationship with Netanyahu to the point where the Republicans invited Netanyahu to speak to Congress without Netanyahu, you know, speaking to the president while he was here. So there were tensions there. But under the last two administrations, Trump and Biden, U.S. support for Israel and disregard for Palestinian rights has been total. You know, Trump proclaimed with his bombastic words and showy actions that relationship. Biden has proclaimed it with his biased words and quieter actions in providing massive weaponry, weaponry that, you know, has been diverted from Ukraine, who really needs it. So Oshkar goes into more detail about Biden's participation in Israel's genocidal war, and including his, you know, Biden's broken promises to reverse Trump's embrace of Israel and the Arab autocracies. You know, Biden, when he was running for election, you know, said that, you know, we're going to have a more distant relationship with Saudi Arabia, and said he was against the Arab-Israeli normalization that excluded the Palestinians in the Abraham Accords. Instead, they pursued them. And he did not reverse the many other provocations by Trump against the Palestinians, including moving the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, closing the U.S. consulate in East Jerusalem, where the Palestinians live, and closing the PLO office in Washington. Instead, Biden has continued Trump's reactionary policies on Israel, Palestine, and the whole Middle East. So, you know, we need to keep pushing for a permanent ceasefire, emergency humanitarian aid, an all-for-all hostage prisoner exchange between Israel and Hamas. And now we got a new demand to restore the funding to UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, which is focused on the Palestinians, providing aid and services to millions of Palestinians, not just in Gaza, but the West Bank, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. And, you know, Israel says that a dozen UNRWA employees were part of the October 7th attack on Israel. But that doesn't excuse collective punishment of millions of Palestinians for the alleged actions of a dozen of UNRWA's 13,000 employees. This is just mean-spirited barbarity on the part of the U.S. And the other thing we have now is the exchange at a little higher level of artillery and missiles between Iranian militias and U.S. forces stationed in Syria and Iraq. This has been a, you know, low-level, endless tit-for-tat going on for years. But now it's escalated. You know, what could stop this? I mean, look, you know, the U.S. bombing Iranian militias and some of their infrastructure is not going to take out those militias or that infrastructure. They'll regroup, reorganize, and fire some salvos back at U.S. bases. What will stop it or help stop it is a ceasefire in Gaza. And that will tone down the low-level war and prevent it from escalating into a full-scale conflict with Iran. So the ceasefire, we got to keep pushing on that. And as I've said, you know, we're moving the needle on it. More and more people in Congress are for it. More countries around the world are for it. And, you know, we just need to keep pushing until we get it. Which brings up this supplemental foreign aid bill, which has been, you know, going on. The negotiations and the debate about it's been going on since, I guess it was October when Biden introduced it. And what it involves is $110 billion, $14 billion for border security on the southern border, $14 billion in weapons for Israel, $61 billion in aid for Ukraine, of which $46 billion is military and about $15 billion is economic, $2 billion for Taiwan self-defense, and then another $10 billion for humanitarian relief in about a dozen countries where there are crises around the world, from Afghanistan to Sudan. And this thing has been languishing. It looks now like the language is going to be published. Maybe it already has. I haven't seen it this morning, but it will this weekend, they say. But the House Speaker, Mike Johnson, has said, quote unquote, it's dead on arrival. He hadn't even seen the text, but he probably knows the outlines. And the fact is, the MAGA Republicans like Johnson could not care less about any of the issues in this package. They don't care about Israelis, Palestinians, or Ukrainians. They don't really think there's a border, quote unquote, invasion that they've been ranting and raving about. They don't think it's really a national security crisis. It's a political, wedge issue that they're using to mobilize their base. And all they care about is getting Republicans elected, and they won't do anything productive to pass a bill like this under Biden. So the question now is, will the moderate Republicans, and moderate is, I guess you got to put that in quotes, because these are very conservative people, but they're not as crazy as the MAGA Republicans, will they vote with the Democrats to force a vote on this bill in the House, which Johnson doesn't want to bring forward? They can do it through a discharge petition. And so the question is, are they going to do that? If they don't, there's talk about the Senate passing legislation, this legislation in pieces, you know, separate the Israeli aid, the Ukraine aid, the border security, and the other pieces, and have separate votes on each. I think that would be a good outcome, because then we'll get members of Congress on the record separately for the Ukraine aid, which should pass, the Israeli aid, which should not pass, the anti-immigrant border security, which is draconian, it should not pass, it's very anti-immigrant, and then the Taiwan and humanitarian aid, which should pass. And the question would then again become, will, you know, once it passes in the Senate, will the moderate, quote unquote, Republicans join with the Democrats, if they have to, with the discharge petition to get a vote on the floor? So that's all up in the air. And the aid to Ukraine, and this is the last thing I'll talk about, what's going on in Ukraine, is desperately needed. Ukraine is running out of ammunition shells and anti-air missiles, anti-air defense missiles. And the Kremlin is promoting the narrative that Ukraine is losing and therefore it should sue for peace and we should support that. But the fact is, Ukraine is not losing, but it could lose if this US aid package is not adopted. I mean, think about it. Russia was the world's third largest military force after the US and China when they invaded and thought they could take over Kyiv in a couple of days and install a puppet government and control all of Ukraine. They didn't count on the Ukrainians who resisted and fought and defeated them in that effort. And over the course of the first year of the war, the Ukrainians pushed Russia out of about half of the land that they had initially occupied with their invasion. This last year, it's been, the front line has been pretty much stuck in place. But there are other things going on. It's not just about the front line. Russia's Black Sea Fleet has been effectively taken out of the war by drone boats, Ukrainian drone boats. It had, you know, the fleet said it was going to block Ukrainian grain shipments. Well, Ukraine grain shipments are now going forward, and the Russian Black Sea Fleet can't do anything about it. They lost another ship, got sunk by drone boats this week. So that, you know, safe corridor for exporting grain and other goods from Ukrainian ports in Odessa and Mykolaiv is going on. And then in recent weeks, Ukrainian air defense systems have shot down about half a dozen Su-34 fighter jets, which are actually more sophisticated than the F-16s that are supposedly headed for Ukraine. They still aren't there. They were shot down over the Azov Sea and in some other places. And that means those fighter jets, Russian fighter jets, can't get close enough to the front lines to launch the gliding bombs at Ukrainian positions. So that's a victory for Ukraine. And then Ukrainian drones have been making devastating strikes on Russian oil refineries from the Baltic Sea in the north near St. Petersburg to the Black Sea in the south. And a couple of days ago, Russia's energy ministry announced that it's cutting exports of gasoline by 37% and of diesel by 23% because their refining capacity has been crippled. And those fuel exports are crucial to generating revenues to finance Russia's war machine. So Ukraine is not losing the war. That's the Kremlin narrative and the narrative of the campus, you know, who don't support Ukraine. Ukraine is not winning the war, hasn't won the war, because they want to push Ukraine, I mean, Russia out of all Ukrainian territories. It means the war is going on and it's fluid. So that narrative about Ukraine can't win or it's losing and it's time to, you know, Stop giving them arms so they can sue for peace. I mean, what the hell do you think Russia's going to do? I mean, Putin said this week, he didn't talk about special military operation to denazify Ukraine and liberate Russian speakers. He talked about the lands he had conquered, and he's not going to give them up. I mean, I don't know whether that was a mistake or, you know, but it revealed what they've really been doing. So these weapons that Ukraine needs, particularly artillery rounds and air defense missiles, are crucial so they can at least hold the line like they have the last year. And we got to remember that Russia is targeting civilian as well as military targets. You just need to look at the devastation Russian airstrikes are doing to Kharkiv and Kherson apartment blocks. These are cities that Russia almost took Kharkiv and did take Kherson, and Ukraine got it back. Compare that to Donetsk City, which is in the Russian-occupied part of the Donetsk Oblast. It's been under Russian control since 2014. It's been within artillery range of Ukraine for 10 years. It's very close to the front line, which has been frozen for 10 years. But Donetsk is largely intact. It's not flattened. Like if you see pictures of Donetsk and compare it to Mariupol or the parts of Kharkiv and Kherson cities that have been flattened, or towns like Bakhmut and Avdiivka and Marinka, and now Chavis Yar, which is like the next major town west of Bakhmut. Russia is flattening these cities. They're just wiping out all the civilian infrastructure, residences. That's what Russia's invasion is doing. Now, this week, the EU finally came through with a $54 billion aid package. Orban was basically told, you know, get in line or get out. They're ready to throw Hungary out of the EU for its human rights and democracy violations, and now it's obstruction of supporting Ukraine. But the EU package is mostly economic aid for Ukraine's health, education, pension, and infrastructure services and reconstruction. It's definitely needed, but that's a four-year package. So it's really more like 10 or 12 billion a year. And, you know, Ukraine's budget deficit is about 40 billion projected for this next year. So, you know, they need more aid than that. Plus Europe, being the Western imperialists they are, these are loans, not grants. So, you know, they're putting Ukraine in the debt trap like a lot of the global South. And they want to use that to control Ukraine's reconstruction. That's why the U.S. aid is important, because it does provide the military aid. And the economic aid the U.S. has been giving has been mostly in grants over the last few years, which is, you know, what it should be. But Putin is saying his goals have not changed. Denazification, which means regime change and installing a Russian puppet government, and demilitarization, which means the Russian military controls Ukraine. And, you know, there's worry on the Ukrainian side. One of the more popular generals, Major General Dmytro Marchenko, said this week that he thinks Russia is gathering forces to plan another attack on Kyiv, as well as extending their control of the Black Sea coast through Mykolaiv and Odessa Oblast to completely cut Ukraine off from the Black Sea. You know, whether Russia can actually pull that off really depends on whether Ukraine gets artillery munitions and air defense missiles. So that's where that's out. And I'll just wrap up, you know, as consistent anti-imperialists, we should be against Russia's occupation of Ukrainian territories, just as we're against Israel's occupation of Palestinian territories. And, you know, the double standard of the vulgar anti-imperialists who oppose Ukraine's national liberation struggle but support Palestinians' national liberation struggle, that's the same double standard and hypocrisy that Biden has. He just supports the Israeli occupation but not the Russian occupation. It's kind of the flip side of the same kind of campism, whether it's Western campism or pro-Russian campism. It's not anti-imperialism, and that's where we should be. So. That's my evaluation of what's going on in the news and what we should be doing. We should be supporting ceasefire in Gaza and getting those that military aid package and economic aid package to Ukraine. So I'll stop there and see what you have to say. Frankie Lee, how can we pressure this corrupt government to support UNRWA? Gaza needs that aid badly. Well, you know, you probably know the answer to that, Frankie. It's we got to be out on the street demonstrating. We got to be writing letters to our members of Congress, letters to the editor, you know, all the usual things. Plus, where we have green candidates, they've got to, you know, make this demand. I think Jill Stein did. I hope down ballot candidates are as well. You just keep speaking out and trying to build your forces, that are speaking out with that demand. It's going to take pressure because, as I said in the opening, Biden is joined at the hip with the Israeli leadership in this genocidal war in Gaza. And while they do state some reservations and they don't want to see so many civilian casualties, we have yet to see real action like holding up military aid or voting with the rest of the world in a UN General Assembly resolution or a Security Council resolution. When we see that, we'll see the change. And we got to keep pushing for that, but it's going to be a struggle. I mean, we've got a country, as I also discussed in the opening, that has, more and more become tied to Israel, just Israel, right or wrong. And it's become almost, there's more debate about, what Israeli policy should be in Israel, even with its right-wing government and its repressive policies, than there is in the United States. I mean, people who are, expressing pro-Palestinian sentiments are having ramifications in terms of being doxxed and jobs being threatened and, scholarships being threatened, in universities. So it's a hard time to speak out, but we can't let that stop us. Comments on the attacks on Representative Omar. I think I saw a headline. They made another attack. I mean, these are just, it's the Republicans, trying to make a wedge issue to mobilize their forces and demonize, the Democrats. And Ilhan Omar becomes an easy target for them because she's Muslim, she's Black, she's an immigrant. All the things the Republicans, all the kinds of people the Republicans say are causing problems that they're going to solve with their crazy policies. Omar should be defended from these ridiculous attacks. I disagree with her on many policies and her attachment to the Democratic Party, but I think she's a decent person. And, these attacks also, they threaten her physical security because, the crazies in the far right, they're ready to act on this stuff violently. And, Omar's been, a victim of that. Same thing with Cori Bush. She hired security to protect herself, given the, threats of violence against her. And now the Republicans are claiming, without any evidence, that she used campaign funds illegitimately to hire security for her when she's out campaigning. It's pretty mean-spirited stuff. So I think we should support Representative Omar's safety, security, her right to speak, even if we disagree with her on the Democratic Party and maybe some issues. Vicky Cordon, the right wingers are going after Taylor Swift. Yeah, I mean, I think, that gives me hope that they're going to really lose badly in November. I mean, they're going after a very popular person with a large following. She endorsed Biden last time. She'll probably endorse him this time. And then they're going after, you know, NFL viewers who probably, you know, span the spectrum of politics. You know, I count myself on the left, but there are a lot of, you know, conservative right wingers that watch NFL. And her boyfriend, Travis Kelce, is a, you know, NFL star. And the right wingers are, you know, they're drumming up this conspiracy theory that she's become popular because the DNC is promoting her. So when she makes her endorsement of Biden, more people will follow it. It's about as bizarre a conspiracy narrative as you can spin. And, you know, I think it shows, you know, the right wingers are self-destructive and they'll believe anything. They are the worst suckers. I mean, look at QAnon. You know, the world is run by a bunch of pedophiles operating out of pizza parlor basements. It's bizarre. It's just bizarre. It's like these people have just gone batshit crazy. Vicky Corden, I heard some people in trucks went to the border to stop immigration. Yeah, I was kind of interested in that, having, you know, being a retired Teamster and remembering all the hullabaloo about the so-called trucker convoy up in Canada, which turned out to have been financed and organized by far-right racist activists in Canada. And, you know, knowing the industry, having worked in it, I know that truckers just can't, if they work for a company, they just can't take the truck down there and park it. And if they're independent owner operators, they can't afford to do that. And then you looked at most of the trucks, they were these big pickup trucks. You know, there were very few semis. So I looked and, you know, saw what was going down to Eagle Pass, Texas, where there's, you know, supposedly this big confrontation. They had like 40 vehicles and they were most all pickup trucks. I didn't see any semis. So I think, again, this is just being drummed up by the right wingers to try to create this myth that, you know, working people want immigrants, you know, sent back to Mexico and hate the immigrants. And, you know, that's what it's about. It's not about truckers having any interest or even participation in this thing, which doesn't seem to really be that much at this point. Frankie Lee, Howie, do you think the border situation can be resolved? Yeah, I mean, I've talked about that the last, you know, several times in the last, you know, several weeks. I think we should just legalize immigration, give documents to the undocumented, let them work. We have a tight labor market. I was talking with someone who is in the dairy industry in Wisconsin. They need workers. I know that the dairy farms in upstate New York depend on immigrant labor. We just had the Hotel Association, the Hospital Industry Trade Association, ask Governor Hochul of New York to give work permits to the immigrants that have been bussed up here from Texas and Florida because they need help in that industry. So we can absorb the labor. And, you know, these people are coming here because they admire the relative freedom we have and the economic opportunity. We know from statistics that immigrants are very enterprising. They start lots of businesses. They commit far fewer crimes than native-born Americans. They're an asset to our society. And so to resolve it, we just need to be reasonable and humane. Instead, we've got the Republicans trying to make it sound like an invasion of aliens and the damn Democrats going along with that. I mean, we haven't seen the details yet, but apparently the Democrats gave the Republicans a lot of what they were demanding in terms of, you know, remain in Mexico policies, putting people in concentration camps instead of them releasing into the population while they await their asylum hearing, pretty much getting rid of asylum, which is, you know, if the United States is to be a beacon of democracy and human rights and we don't provide asylum to people running from, you know, repression and violence, I mean, what the hell are we? We aren't what we say we want to be. So I think, you know, we really need, that's where the Greens could make a big difference, because the Democrats have pretty much ceded the premises to the Republicans. This phony crisis at the border. Yes, there are a lot of people, record numbers, who are trying to get in, but ask yourself why. Well, a lot of these people are coming from countries like Venezuela, where we impose very strict sanctions, which have further impoverished that country. We've supported right-wing dictators in places like Honduras and Guatemala over the years, which have created repressive environments that people are running from. You know, the whole drug thing is, you know, in Mexico, a lot of people are running from that violence between these drug gangs. But what drives that? It's demand in the U.S. for these drugs that are illegal, which creates an underground economy that where the gangs thrive, instead of making those drugs decriminalized for personal use. So if you are using, you know, cocaine or fentanyl or one of those things, you aren't sent to jail. You're offered treatment so you can, you know, get off your addiction. It'd be a less expensive way of handling it. We've seen the success in Portugal where they've done that. They're starting to do it in Oregon. The problem there is they aren't providing enough services for treatment. So they are getting crime problems. And that's, you know, decriminalization also means providing the services, which should be provided by a universal healthcare system, a national health service under community control, like I've advocated, where drug treatment on demand is a medically necessary service that you get upon demand, no out-of-pocket expenses. It's paid for through a progressive taxation system. So, you know, the border situation can be resolved. And it's, as I've said, an international problem. We've got, you know, in Europe, the far right is rising based on two things. One is anti-immigration, you know, and scapegoating immigrants for problems people have in Europe. The other thing they're scapegoating are climate actions, the European Green Deal, which they say is, you know, causing inflation and raising fuel prices. And so the far right is campaigning against climate action. And they're also campaigning to stop support for Ukraine. That's not such a popular issue, but it's their position. And they are rising in the European parliaments this year. They're probably going to gain. And then you've got, you know, countries I've mentioned, this Tunisia pushing African, sub-Saharan African immigrants back into the Sahara Desert. You got the Burmese or Myanmar government pushing Rohingya back toward Bangladesh, you know, terrible human rights violations. And with climate change, changing climates and people losing agricultural land or living in areas that are too hot where you just can't survive, there's going to be climate migration. We've got to find a way of dealing with this. It should be an international solution, like they tried to do in Europe, where the immigrants are spread among many countries, but that ran into the problems, like with right-wing governments like Orbán's Hungary, which refused to take any immigrants, and then, you know, used the anti-immigrant message to mobilize votes. You know, we see that with the National Rally, the fascist party in France around Marine Le Pen. You see it in Italy, Alternative for Deutschland in Germany. This guy that just got the most votes in the, whose party got, I guess, the most votes in the Dutch elections. It's maybe like 23%, but they won't be part of a coalition government, it looks like, but they are gaining. You see it in the Scandinavian countries, all across Europe. And this is a far right that is a problem, and it's going to make the immigration problem worse. So, yeah, I think, you know, the border situation is really an immigration problem, can be resolved. It can be handled. And, you know, but it cannot be handled by blaming immigrants, migrants who are running away from repression and poverty. You know, we've got to find a way to help those people and integrate them into the, you know, world economy and in various places in a way that's beneficial for all of us. I think I pointed to a study. It was done by some libertarians, but you know, the academic work seems legit. If we just had open borders around the world and people could move to where economic opportunity is, world GDP would double. We'd be twice as rich because we wouldn't have all this labor wasted by people that, you know, are willing to work but can't find jobs. So, yeah, it's a problem that can be solved. I think the solutions are out there. But the whole narrative has got to change. And that's where we need the Green Party to challenge the narrative that's shared by the Democrats and Republicans. Republicans are just more mean-spirited about how they articulate it, but the Democrats reaffirm the Republicans' premises. And that's, you know, creating bad policy that won't solve, you know, the border situation. Dig Doug, if Greens catch fire and challenge the duopoly, would we replace one of the major parties, or would existing parties collapse into a Democratic Republican legislative majority? Well, I think overall nationwide, what we need is proportional representation and ranked choice voting for president, proportional representation in the House. And that will create a multi-party, an inclusive multi-party democracy. I don't think either the Democrats or Republicans will collapse. The people, the rich people in this country that fund those parties, they need that two corporate party system because it gives us the illusion of choice when in fact both parties agree on the basic economic and foreign policies the United States pursues. Neoliberal economic policies and neoconservative imperialist policies abroad. Now in localities, you may find where, you know, the Greens, gain ground, even electing a legislative majority on a city council. You may see the Democrats and Republicans come together. We saw that in, 2002 or three, when Matt Gonzalez, the Green candidate for mayor of San Francisco, got into the runoff against Gavin Newsom, who's now the governor of California, and, talked about being a presidential candidate in place of Biden or the next cycle. And what happened then was the Republicans, who are a minority in San Francisco, their candidate didn't get through, so they supported Gavin Newsom. So we had a Republican-Democratic coalition to defeat the Green. And it was a close election. I mean, Matt won the vote counted on election day, and Gavin Newsom squeezed ahead when they counted the ballots submitted on paper ballots. And I've always questioned, you know, how much, you know, whether those ballots, there wasn't some ballot stuffing at that time. You know, this was early on when they were doing mail-in ballots. And I'm not sure all the checks that we have now are in place. In any case, you know, that's a case where the Green was doing well, looked like they might win. So the Democrats and Republicans got together to defeat the Green. So you could see that in localities, but I think overall, we won't see the two major parties collapse. What we will see is a multi-party system, but that requires changing the electoral system. So it's, instead of, you know, winner take all, plurality wins, it becomes proportional representation, where every party gets its fair share of representation and power based on the share of the vote it gets. And then if that happens, I could see the Greens becoming the biggest party. You look at our platform compared to the Democrats and Republicans, you know, our leading issues like Medicare for All, Green New Deal, tax the rich, and others poll much better than the policies of the Democrats and Republicans on those questions. So once we get into the legislatures and we have that legitimate platform from which to present our views and our policy proposals, I think we're going to win more support than even we have now. And, you know, the public opinion polls show that. The big problem in American politics is that public opinion doesn't translate into public policy because of this two corporate party system. So we need an inclusive multi-party democracy through proportional representation. That's how I think we'll end up getting beyond the duopoly. If we don't get rid of winner-take-all plurality elections, You're going to have a duopoly. It's called Duverger's Law, a political scientist in France. He came up with this analysis in the 1950s that when you have winner-take-all plurality elections, you naturally get two major parties because a third party that may be smaller than the two big parties will end up dividing the vote or perceived to be dividing the vote for the party closest to it. So its support diminishes and people settle for the lesser evil. That dynamic is really strong. And I think it's going to be in effect this year. I mean, a lot of people are hopeful the Greens' vote will really go up because so many people, 63% according to the last Gallup poll, want a third major party. And, you know, Jill Stein and Cornel West are polling between 1% and 4%. In the polls, if you look at the, you know, collections of polls like at 538 or Real Clear Politics, you'll see that, you know, when it's a national poll, Stein and West each get about closer to 4%. If it's a poll in a competitive battleground state, they get closer to 1%. And if those numbers held, there would be more votes than we've ever gotten. The most we ever got was 2.74% with Ralph Nader in 2000. And then, of course, Kennedy's in the teens in his polling. Although when people find out what a conspiracy nut he is and how right-wing he is on immigration and Israel, and even some of the things he said about climate change are just, you know, conspiracy, QAnon crazy. I think as people find out more about who he really is and not just the Kennedy name, his poll numbers will go down. But in any case, in the end, I think if it's between Biden and Trump, most progressives are going to say, damn, we can't have Trump. And they're going to vote for Biden, hold their nose and vote for Biden, genocide Joe. It's going to be a tough choice for them. But of course, there's at least 500,000 Greens out there who are just going to say no to genocide Joe, and they're going to vote for Jill Stein just because, as I would agree, their vote is their voice. And if you want Medicare for all, the Green New Deal, and the other things the Greens stand for that Biden opposes, nobody's going to hear you. As I was saying during the 2020 campaign, you get lost in the sauce. Nobody knows you're for those things if you vote for Biden. If you vote for the Green, you know, that registers that opinion. And I think that's the most effective use of your vote. But anyway, I'm getting off the question. The question is, what'll happen when the duopoly breaks up? I think we break it up by going to proportional representation and an inclusive multi-party democracy, which will have four or five, you know, pretty large parties. B.D. Dimmitt, hello. Half an hour after this event, there is another event in Chicago, billed as a conversation between Drs. Stein and West. It'll be live streamed at, and there's the email address. I was not aware of that. This must have just come up. Let's put that link in the chat so people can get it. And yeah, that'll be an interesting conversation. I guess I will tune in because I'm curious to see what they have to say to each other. I know Stein has said she would welcome West as her vice presidential candidate. And I think that would be pretty powerful. They're both well known. West's strength is speaking to the public and the media. Stein has a campaign organization, which is not West's strength. He's going to have trouble with ballot access, so that would be good. So I hope that comes up in that conversation. You know, I have my differences with both of them, particularly on Ukraine, but, you know, it's either them or Genocide Joe, and I guess I'm going with them. Or at least Jill, because she's building the party. West is just running a one-off campaign for himself. He was in the news that he's formed a party, Justice for All, but that's a ballot access device. In some states, it's easier to get on a ballot as a party than as an independent. And that's something Ralph Nader did when he ran as an independent in 2004 and 2008. It's what a lot of third-party or independent candidates have done. George Wallace did it in 1968, setting up parties in some states. John Anderson did it in 1980. I don't think West, there's no indication he's really going to organize a party. That is, if he couldn't go through the Greens, conventions and primaries to get the nominations. He's not going to build a party, which is even more, far more complicated and requires far more attention. So anyway, that's news you may have heard, but I don't think it's a real party. It's a ballot access vehicle. Scout Trooper 164, I really can't tell if Cornell believes what he says. Jump from the People's to the Green to Independent to Justice Party. I don't think it'll help more ballot options. Just make lip service. Now, it will help with ballot access. You look at the state by state, Ballot Access News publishes a chart every month or so that shows, you know, how different independent campaigns or third-party campaigns are doing on ballot access, and it lists in the left-hand columns how many signatures you need to get on as a party or get on as an independent. In a lot of cases, the party number is much smaller. So I think it is a ballot access vehicle. I don't think it's just a messaging thing about a Justice for All party. Cornell has said things like he doesn't believe in parties, which I think is a big mistake. We need a way to collectively discuss, organize, develop common policy positions and then organize around them, not just have, you know, individuals. If you leave it to individual independents, it's mostly going to be left to high profile personalities and especially people that are backed by billionaires. That's not very damn democratic. Emil Sachs, how many states is it even an issue? Who you pick for president? In Oregon, it means nothing. 7 to 8 electoral votes. Laugh out loud. Remember when Dems pretended to dislike the Electoral College? Yeah, that's another case of Democratic Party hypocrisy. I remember when, right after Bush v. Gore came out, and the Supreme Court handed the presidency to George Bush without finishing the recount in Florida. Hillary Clinton, who had just first got elected to U.S. Senate, in her first news conference in Binghamton, New York, said that she was going to introduce a bill to abolish the Electoral College. In fact, Dick Durbin already had a bill in the previous session. And then you come to the session where Clinton was elected that first Congress in 2001. She never introduced a bill. Dick Durbin didn't reintroduce his bill. And the Democrats punted on that. Now, the session after that, the Durbin bill got reintroduced, and there's been a version of it ever since, but it's not been an issue for the Democrats. It has a small number of sponsors. Nobody's campaigning or organizing around it. So the Democrats, you would think, given that the only Republicans elected in the 21st century were first elected by the Electoral College after they lost the popular vote, you would think the Democrats say, hey, we got a problem here. Let's campaign to get rid of the Electoral College. You know what they do? They blame the Greens. We're splitting their vote as if they own our vote. And they don't recognize that for most Greens who vote Green, that's a Green vote, not a wayward Democratic vote. You know, most Greens are not going to vote for the Democrats. They're just too angry at what the Democrats have done, whether it's supporting the war in Iraq, opposing the Green New Deal, opposing single-payer Medicare for all, local issues having to do with housing or police accountability. Too many progressives find that Democrats are on the other side of the barricades, the other side of the fight of their progressive demands. And that's who comes to the Green Party. And they're not going back to the Democrats. They've had it. So the idea that, if the Greens should just go away and all those votes will go to the Democrats is just not true. As I pointed out many times, the exit poll after the 2016 election asked the supporters of Jill Stein and Gary Johnson, the Green and the Libertarian, who they would have voted for if their candidate was not on the ballot. 61% of Jill Stein's voters said they wouldn't have voted. 25% said they would have voted for Clinton and 14% for Trump. You plug those numbers into the close states that year, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, Trump still wins. Gary Johnson, it was 54% said they would not vote. And I forget how it broke down between Clinton and Trump, but same thing. Most third party voters, given our winner take all plurality system, where it's, you know, you really got to believe in your third party vote to vote for it, given the dynamics of that system. Those green votes are green votes. So, you know, again, here's an issue because the Democrats won't take it up seriously to replace the Electoral College with a ranked choice national popular vote for president. That's what the Greens have got to promote. And it's something I wish that both Jill Stein and Cornel West would put a bigger emphasis on. There's still a lot of time. And what I've been saying is they should demand that Joe Biden join them in replacing the Electoral College with a ranked choice national popular vote for president. And of course, they're called spoilers. But if Joe Biden won't join them in that demand, he's the spoiler. He's perpetuating the system that sets up the spoiler problem. So I think that's an issue that can be turned around on these, you know, Democratic spokespeople that try to shame people into voting for the Democrats to stop Trump. When, you know, a lot of Greens want to vote for what they believe in, you know, Medicare for all, an economic bill of rights, Green New Deal, peace policies. So in the first part of the question, how many states is it even an issue? Well, one thing that comes to mind there is that except for 4 to 7, depending on the pollster and the political scientist you consult, except for 4 to 7 states, we already know who's going to win, you know, these states. They're either, you know, majority blue or majority red, majority Democrat or majority Republican. It's only in a few states where it's competitive. So, you know, your vote in those states is your opportunity to, those states that are not competitive, your opportunity to really speak up for what you want. In the competitive states, you know, you got to make a strategic decision. You want to vote for what you want, or you want to vote to stop Trump. I mean, that's the dilemma that progressives have in those states. But anyway, I think the point of that first sentence is that it's given the winner-take-all electoral college system, state by state, we already know who's won, you know, somewhere between, 44 and 47 of the states. You know, we can all go to Las Vegas and win a lot of money betting that those states are going to go for one candidate or the other. It's only competitive in a few states. Beatty Dimmitt, are there states that are majority neither of the above? I think, I'm not sure. Nevada may have a none of the above option, but I'm not sure in presidential elections. I mean, the function where none of the above has been adopted is if none of the above wins, then you have a new election with new candidates. But I don't know of any states that actually do that, especially in presidential elections, because it's a national election. So a state not giving electoral votes to either would kind of take the state out of the whole equation. And I don't think any state would want to do that. So I don't think none of the above plays out in the presidential election. I don't mean officially, I mean non-affiliated. You mean states where the majority of voters are not affiliated with either Democrat or Republican. There are a number of states like that, and it's growing. I couldn't tell you off the top of my head, but you can, you know, find those statistics online pretty easily. Yeah, and nationally, there are now more people that are not affiliated with either Democrat or Republican than are affiliated with Democrat and Republican, both of whom are losing people affiliated with those parties steadily. You know, majority of people want something else. LZ, Biden can't win, lost too much base. So a vote for Biden is a vote for Trump. Go green. A vote for Biden is a vote for Trump. I don't know if I go that far, but it's a wasted vote. I would agree with you there. But I don't know. I think it's too early to tell. You saw the Quinnipiac poll this week, which had Biden substantially ahead in the national poll. I forget what the percent was, maybe 5 points. And his gap grew when the third party candidates were included against conventional wisdom. And I think that's because Kennedy is drawing a lot from the Republicans on the right. So I think, but I would argue, I'd agree with you to the extent that a vote for Biden is a wasted vote, because you're not voting for what you want and telling the world where you stand and showing the world that there's support for those things the Greens stand for. I think that's the best way to use your vote. But, you know, I don't know. Yeah, I wouldn't call it fortunate, but compared to Trump, maybe fortunate. I think Biden can win. I don't think it's guaranteed by any means, but I think it's a toss-up at least. Amy L. Sachs, I think another Dem just jumped into the Washington race with the incumbent and the Green Party candidate, Jason Call. Yeah, I saw a note from Jason Call about that. Hard to keep up with all the twists and turns, though. Yeah, so, and Jason says that's good, gives him more of a chance to get into the second round. Washington has one of those stupid top two systems where they have a nonpartisan primary of candidates from every party, including multiple candidates from parties. It takes the nomination process away from the parties. California has the same thing. And so those, the two candidates that get the most votes in the primary move on to the general election and have a runoff. And so you could have two Democrats. You could have two Republicans. It depends on the district. This is a majority Democratic district. So the question is whether it's going to be two Democrats in the general election or Jason and a Democrat in the general election. So he's hopeful that having two Democrats gives him a better chance to get into the final race compared to when there was a Republican and a Democrat and a Green. I can't evaluate that. I'd have to look at the numbers and study it, but I hope he's right. And I hope he does make it to the general election. Petey Dimmitt, would one election cycle with the Green President of the United States campaign topping 5% be enough to break through the two-party lock? I think it would give the Greens a lot more resources in the subsequent presidential election. And, you know, for people not familiar, there'll be a little bit over $100 million available for the presidential campaigns that get over 5%. If they get over 25%, they're considered a major party and they get the full 100 and whatever million dollars. If it's between 5 and 25%, they get a prorated portion of that. So if the Greens got just 5%, it would be at least $20 million. But it could only be used by the Green nominee for in September and October of the 2028 presidential campaign, which would be great. You know, we could do some TV advertising, put a lot of field organizers out there, maybe borrow against that money earlier in the campaign to fund ballot access and so forth. But it's changed. It used to be there was public money for organizing the convention, the national convention of that presidential year. And, you know, the Greens interpreted that to mean we could use that money earlier to organize state parties and build our parties in preparation for that convention. That was taken away under the Obama administration. So all that's left is this grant for September and October, it would be the 2028 election. So I don't think that on itself is enough to break the two-party lock. As I said, I think the way we break that is to go to proportional representation so that you have the Greens and, you know, probably the Libertarians and maybe another third party, along with the Democrats and Republicans, represented in Congress. So when you turn on CNN and they're getting comments from members of Congress, the Greens are in there along with the Democrats and Republicans. That would be a whole change in the political culture. That would break the two-party lock. I think that's what we got to focus on. Changing the plurality winner system, winner-take-all system, to proportional representation. And for single executive officers like president, just ranked choice voting. Okay, well, today I guess people want to talk about the presidential election and what's going on there. I guess some of us are going to watch this Stein-West conversation, which I didn't know about. So I guess all of us learned something, at least we learned that in this conversation. And, you know, we'll be back next week and we'll talk about what's going on. So everybody have a good week and stay active. It makes a difference. I know people sometimes get discouraged, but believe me, we can make changes. So have a good week, everybody.